Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Maureen Rutten. Today we're really focusing on poetry.
Is it all poetry? Yes, of course it is.
Yes, yeah. Well, Bill from Scorpio is coming in to tell us what people are reading, but I'm talking with two of my very favourite poets and celebrating the fact that Robert Sullivan is now the Poet Laureate.
Kia ora.
Kia ora to that, indeed. And then I'm talking to Paula Green, someone who is so active and supportive of poetry in New Zealand. She has just written a book of poems called The Venetian Blind Poems, which were written during her treatment and recovery from a very severe form of blood cancer.
And I listened to that interview, Maureen, and our listeners can expect a real treat with Paula reading to them a couple of the poems from that book. It was very beautiful. I'll have to get Belle to focus in on some poetry reading tips then so we can complete the theme for the show. Belle's always such a treat from Scorpio, and we're very lucky to have Scorpio as our sponsors for the show. So big shout out to them. And that's it for this week.
So this is a poem called Waka 16, Kua Whetu Rangi Tia Koe, which means you've become a star. And it comes from Star Waka. The term Kua Whetu Rangi Tia Koe is really referring to a loved one who has passed away and is highly regarded, and they've become a guiding star in the heavens. Beloved, sent to Hawaiki, to become a star who guides dreamers to reality, to become a star portrait on the cloak of a knight on whose shoulders rest dreams of a restless people who dream white waves of currency, waka rides and falls, black and blue with only stars to point away since sun and moon are tagged for domination. Yet stars are ancestors. They are stars, our ancestors, and we will be stars like Kauri, Tōtara, Kahikatea, Nemu, Awa, tapped for fire, sapped for gum, used for battle, construction materials, veins into dams where the power of the land powers a mechanical culture, strange ships in the sky, air filled with radiation. We're vacuumed into this culture of menace to the land. We're told we'd do this too if we had the technology. And our people do it to the land, for people, by people. And this land joins the Congress of Scars on the planet, a culture of urban decay and renewal, a culture of dead capitals sucking the life out of new cities, a culture that knows no boundaries, has only prophecies called strategies. And stars look down on this. And eyes of divinities look down on stars, and eyes of the powerless look up, but only at night, when machines lighten blackness, when many stars are lost in the lightning, except in the papakainga, from tops of pā, from middle of ocean, from these places, stars meant to be seen can be.
That was our new Poet Laureate, Robert Sullivan, reading from one of his collections of poetry, Star Waka. Robert has written 9 books of poetry, many award-winning. He has been an associate professor teaching creative writing at the University of Hawaii. He's edited anthologies with various other poets, particularly highlighting Polynesian poetry, and his most recent work, Hoparangi Songcatcher, was shortlisted for the Poetry Award this year. He has been described as amplifying Māori and Pacific voices, that he has great standing, considerable mana, and leads with grace and humility. First of all, congratulations, Robert, on this.
Oh, kia ora. Kia ora, Maureen. It's so nice of you to say, and thank you for that introduction too. It's really cool. Thank you.
Well, sort of cobbled together, because I could spend the whole of our time going through all the things that you've done. But this seems like a very fitting title for you. It's got a very straightforward, I'm running out of words now. It's a really straightforward task for you, isn't it? It's to promote poetry.
Well, I've been doing it for quite a long time, but not to promote. For me, it's to share poetry. And, like you mentioned with the anthologies, I've just been really lucky to work with some great people like Albert Wendt and Raina Faitiri in particular, on anthologies to, present our voices within, all the cacophony of mainstream voices that we have in our literature. Why does it matter to be an Indigenous writer? Why does Indigenous writing matter? And I think those sorts of anthologies help answer that.
Yes, they have certainly brought those voices to the fore, and I think we're all the richer for it. And I guess, your task, as I say, of promoting and sharing poetry is just continuing something that you've been doing right from the start.
Yes, I was adding up the years. It's 40 years. I think it's either this year or next year. So I started writing seriously when I was 18. So, yeah, I've got a birthday coming up, so it must be from about then.
Yes. Well, I noticed that your first book, Jazz Waiata, won the Penn First Book Award. That was back in 1991.
Yeah, that's right. And I was actually, in that book, I had material in there from when I was 18. And again, I was getting mentored by lots of good poets like Michelle Leggett back then. And it's partly, through the support of AUP, since 1990 when the book came out. And here I am, just been very lucky.
Oh, not just lucky, working hard and having talent. And when did you first recognise that poetry was something you wanted to put your efforts into or devote your life to?
I often talk about my Standard 4 teacher. I think that's Year 6, Mrs. Nair, who did a class poetry exercise. She got our class to go out and write cloud poems. We all lay on the grass in front of the school, and we looked up and saw these clouds. And I was the only one who wrote a non-fluffy kind of poem. I wrote about this alligator that I really did see, I thought. And I put that in my poem. And she made such a big deal about that. I just had a very positive early memory of poetry and literacy. And then I had this really great seventh form English teacher at my high school, John Hayes, who was also principal at Mangere College, but back then he was at Auckland Grammar. And he taught us about Ted Hughes, and he was also teaching us poets like Bernice Wenera. And, he really gave us a sort of a pre-university dive into poetry and the seriousness that you could regard poetry with. So I really respected the poetic voice, I guess, quite young. And
yeah.
Then, university, that's when I, got to meet Albert and his friends too.
And you obviously, you obviously decided that teaching would be a good way of extending your talent and skill as well?
Well, again, it's just good luck. Because I was actually going to be a librarian. I'd done the professional qualification and I was managing a library team at Auckland University Library. And I was all set for that career. But then I got a phone call from Hawaii and they asked me to come over for a semester. And it was a kind of a teaching fellowship. So, of course, I said, yeah. And I learnt how to teach over there and teach in the American style, using writing prompts and the Iowa style of teaching in the workshop kind of mode. And then I ended up getting a job there. And that's how I ended up in teaching creative writing. And I met a lot of young writers that way over the years.
Yes, that would have been a remarkable thing. And being in Hawaii, you know, the wonderful, well, it's part of the Polynesian culture, it's part of Maori culture, it's you know, extends all over. So you would have been immersed in that world.
Yeah, it was like a parallel world to Aotearoa because, you know, Kanaka Māori have similar experiences of colonisation, but it was more rapid for them because it was like within a century, whereas for us it's been a bit longer. And, of course, we're related and we have some of the same mythological heroes and, you know, and also just like for Māori, the Hawaiians have a large number of poets. Or saying what they need to say. So, yeah, it was a great experience.
Coming back here, that's when you started, I think, I might not have the dates right, but that's when you started collaboration with Albert and Rainer in putting those anthologies together. Did that come from, I mean, I guess it came from you all thinking that this was the right time to do that, but your experience in Hawaii would have affected you?
Yeah, well, we were all there at the same time, Al and Rainer. Albert's a pioneer, of course, of literature in the Pacific. So his anthologizing work is a lot earlier, like with Lali and Nuanua, those contemporary Pacific anthologies, which included more than just poetry. But our anthologies were focused on poetry because that's what I really love. And they indulged me, I guess.
Well, indulging is a lovely thing to be given that space to do yeah. What you want to do, but there must have been, you know, a really strong sense that you were all working towards the same goal.
Yeah, well, it's to share the huge variety of Indigenous voices that we have here, and not to limit our expectations of what an Indigenous voice an Indigenous worldview brings to literature. So, we all are on that kaupapa for sure.
So being the Poet Laureate is going to require a lot of travel, a lot of coming and going, a lot of being out there and making statements, I guess, when you feel they need to be made, being part of a lot of poetry events, coming up with your own. What sort of ideas have been percolating around in your head since you heard that you're going to be the laureate?
Well, I'd quite like to set up a poet laureate shop here in Oamaru, where I live. So we have these beautiful buildings now with the white stone, the Oamaru stone in our Victorian precinct. And I thought, gosh, if I could get a little shop and run workshops there and put them online as well, because to travel from here is a challenge because we don't have our own airport. But of course, I'd love to take part in other readings. One other idea I had was to set up a community libraries event where we do a kind of a national reading, where we have local readings emceed by local poets, and then we zoom in to the national reading linked up by, I guess, something like Zoom. And I'm still forming that idea, but I thought that would be a lot of fun too.
Yeah, I like the idea of having a shop in Noamaru. I'll be dropping in when I travel south.
Oh, that'd be brilliant. You're welcome.
Robert, it's a huge thing for you, and I think the whole New Zealand and Pacific-wide poetry community will be applauding your taking on the role. Would you like to finish by reading us another poem?
Oh, thanks, Maureen. Thanks again, you know, for saying such nice things. Really, I am very lucky. So I thought I'd read Waka 99, which is near the end of Star Waka. And here we go, Waka 99. If Waka could be resurrected, they wouldn't just come out from museum doors, smashing glass cases, revolving and sliding doors on their exit. They wouldn't just come out of mountains as if liquefied from a frozen state. The resurrection wouldn't just come about this way. The South Island turned to wood, waiting for the giant crew of Maui and his brothers, bailers and anchors turned back to what they were when they were strewn about the country by Kupe and his relations. The resurrection would happen in the blood of the women and men, the girls and boys, who are blood relations of the crews, whose veins touch the veins, who touch the veins of those who touch the veins, who touch the veins, who touched the veins of the men and women from the time of Kupe and before. The resurrection will come out of their blood.
Ngā mihi, Robert. Robert Sullivan, our new poet laureate.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM. Streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Kia ora, listeners. I am joined in the studio by Belle Moneypenny from Scorpio Books for yet another fabulous roundup of all of the books that we should be reading this month. What's flying off the shelves?
Should be reading this month.
Even if we haven't read all of them.
Even if we haven't read all of them.
Yet. We've got a whole month to do so.
That's right. So I was just going to talk about fiction today because it's September and this is when things really start heating up in the publishing world. It's when the best books start rolling out, prizes are announced, there's so many big books coming out for Christmas. It's very exciting. But I looked at the numbers and there are some real crackers on the nonfiction.
Cool. Cool.
Yeah, so as well that I thought we should start with. So
excellent.
We'll start there. So our top three biographies for this month, we start, of course, with local Grant Robertson, Anything Could Happen. And this is a fascinating and in-depth insight into the remarkable life and career of one of the most influential politicians of his generation.
Indeed. Can I just say about this Grant Robertson?
Yes.
He is almost, in my experience, as divisive a politician of his era as Jacinda
as
was.
As Jacinda, yeah.
Like, if I speak with my buddies who vote other to me, there's as much kind of critique and anger reserved for the politics of Grant. So this is a book that might find quite a divisive reaction.
Yeah, and I think we'll still be read on both sides of that political fence. So, he's a natural-born storyteller, and it's actually quite beautifully written, so it's also just a lovely book to read. But he reflects on the major events in his life, from growing up in a loving but complex family right through to his highly successful career as a Labor politician and becoming finance minister for the Ardern government. So, yes, he talks about his childhood and teen years in Dunedin, about his grappling with his sexuality as a teenager, his passion for music and fleeting career managing bands.
His passion for music, which got him in trouble playing the wrong music to the crowd.
Indeed, yeah. Indeed. And then as his political beliefs emerged and being told the shocking news that his father had been stealing from his employer and was facing imprisonment. So he paints also a very vivid picture of life inside Parliament, including his time in opposition, where he was working with Helen Clark. And, yes, that tumultuous COVID time as well when he was finance minister. So I think there's a lot in this book that people were wanting in the Ardern biography, but were left a little bit hungry for. So there is more in this book. So definitely worth picking up, worth a read, regardless of your politics.
Regardless of your politics, exactly. Mm. And I think people on both sides would appreciate that he was always a great raconteur. And so looking forward to reading that from a storytelling point of view.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, what else have we got?
So number two is not a new book, but it's rocketed back up the charts because it won the Women's Prize for nonfiction this year, and that is The Story of a Heart by Rachel Clark. In fact, I'm pretty sure she's Dr. Rachel Clark, actually. So it was also shortlisted for the Bailey Gifford Prize for Nonfiction last year, was a book of the year in The Guardian and The Times and The Spectator and The New Statesman and The New Scientist, and I will tell you why. So the heart is the first of our organs to form and the last to die. I didn't know that. Isn't that fascinating? It's both a simple pump and the symbol of all that makes us human. And this is the tragic and moving story of how one summer day, 9-year-old Kira suffered catastrophic injuries in a car accident. And in an extraordinary act of generosity, her parents and her siblings decide that she would have wanted to be a donor. And so then we have also 9-year-old Max, who has been hospitalised for nearly a year with a virus that was causing his young heart to fail. And his parents receive the call they had been hoping for, but they know that it comes at the terrible cost to another family. So this is the amazing story of how one family's grief is transformed into a life-saving gift. But it's much more than that as well. So the author, Rachel Clark, describes the urgent journey of this young girl's heart, but also explores the remarkable history of medical innovation. And she goes back over a century and looks at the dedication of countless surgeons and physicians and immunologists and nurses and scientists who have all built on this knowledge and experience that led to these incredible acts.
A wonderful celebration of humanity and caring.
Exactly.
And science.
And science.
Yay.
So, yes, very much a life-affirming and uplifting read, despite the also huge sadness in it as well. And it's very popular and people are loving it. So highly recommend that one. And then at number three, on a much lighter note, we have the always delightful Lucy Mangan with her book, Bookish, How Reading Shapes Our Lives. And this follows on from her earlier book, Bookworm. But, and this again is a love letter to all those who come alive when they pull a new treasure off the shelf. Those who stay up late reading just one more page and pack their suitcases with clothes wedged between books rather than the other way around, which I can identify with enormously.
Thank goodness for Kindle is what I say.
Yes, yes indeed. So from exploring the stacks as a student to finding her feet as a bookseller turned journalist, then she's falling in love with a fellow bookworm in an independent bookstore, escaping the doldrums of new motherhood and finally building a book room of her own. So it's the story of her life loving books, really, which is delightful, and it comes with so many recommendations along the way.
Oh, wow. Well, as if we need any more recommendations, there's just so many good books.
So many. But what I love about Lucy is that she just reads so broadly. So it's not just all high literature. It's she talks about chronicling her years of buying, borrowing, hoarding everything from well-worn literary classics to steamy bonkbusters, gripping thrillers, young adult novels, and not-so-guilty pleasures. So it's a really broad spectrum.
Excellent.
And an absolutely delightful read.
And a cool way of you getting more recommendations into one session.
Into one session. That's right. We just keep going and going.
Very good. Thank you very much. Bookish by Lucy Mangan.
That's it. So that is nonfiction. We'll move on to fiction, and the New Zealand fiction is the same as it was the last month, as it was the month before that. Can you remember?
Oh, I think it was Catherine Chidji.
You are right. Bang on. And Damien Wilkins' and Delirious and 1985 by Dominic Hoey. But there is one exciting thing to add here, and that is that given the huge success of Damien Wilkins' Delirious, his Ockham-winning novel this year, his publisher, Te Haerenga Waka University Press, have republished one of his earlier novels called Chemistry, this one.
Beautiful.
Which is fabulous because a lot of his books are now out of print and quite hard to get. So if you loved Delirious, like me, and have been hungry for all of his backlist, then you should dive into this one.
Or you could download as well. You could,
as well.
As well, you could download the interview that Maureen did with Damien recently.
Yes.
And did you go and see Damien at Word? Was he one of the sessions that you attended?
I did. I saw all his sessions like a little fangirl.
Oh, fabulous. Fabulous.
Yes, and it was
Aren't
great.
We lucky?
It was really great. So this novel, it was written about 20 years ago. I mean, he's written 14 novels. Mm. It's a crime that we can't get them all. But this one is about a man called Jamie, who is a 41-year-old drug addict. His kidneys, master chemists of the body, have just produced a stone. He's in terrible pain and he needs surgery, which is great news for someone who is hungry for pharmaceuticals. However, the hospital stay doesn't quite work out, and knowing it's the lowest thing he's ever done, he decides to go somewhere where he hasn't been in years, and that is home to Timaru, where quite conveniently he has a brother who is a chemist and a sister who is a doctor. So surely this pair, with their access to pharmaceuticals and their blood ties, will help him. And if all else fails, there is Jamie's insomniac mother, who has various prescriptions running around her bathroom cabinet. So this novel, Chemistry, is a story about bad choices and those who suffer the consequences. It's also a story about the resourcefulness of the sufferers, about those who come through, which so it's not all dark, as Wilkins does so well. There is humour in there as well. Darkly funny and frightening. It's a novel fastened hard to the recognisable details of small-town New Zealand life, which he's also really good at. And it moves with great force towards an explosive conclusion. So
cool.
That is definitely one to
While it's reprinted. Excellent.
Exactly. So there's that. Then I'm going to talk about a couple of international fiction titles. One that is absolutely flying off the shelves, though it has just come out, is Catabasis by R.F. Kuang. I'll pass you that. So this is fantasy. It's dark academia.
Dark academia.
Yeah. So she also wrote Babel and Yellowface, which were both very sensational events in the publishing world. And this is a book that is dividing people. It's getting a lot of attention, as did both her previous books. But in terms of the theme, it's closer to her earlier novel, Babel, rather than to Yellowface. So Catabasis is from ancient Greek, and it means descent into the underworld. And it's a novel that draws very heavily on Dante's Inferno. So our main character, grad student Alice Law, has only ever had one goal, and that is to become the brightest mind in the field of analytic magic. But the only person who can make her dream come true is dead and, inconveniently, in hell. And Alice, along with her biggest rival, Peter Murdoch, is going after him. But hell is not as the philosophers claim. Its rules are upside down, and if she's going to get out of there alive, she and Peter, her nemesis, will have to work together. But that's if they can agree on anything. So will they triumph or will they kill each other trying? Now, this one, I think, is going to be sort of a Coriander book. Like, it's going to, people will either love it or hate it. So she, when she writes her books, she has a point and she drives at it hard. So some people love that and some people don't. And it's going to be the book that we discuss at our book club on the 7th of October, if people are interested in coming along.
Okay. I'll have to add it to my reading list so that I can come along to that because I've got that in my diary.
Do come along.
I can't wait.
So tickets are on our website.
It sounds hard, this book.
Well, no,
it
it's not.
Quite
it's
hard?
No, no, it's extremely readable.
Okay.
Very accessible.
Phew.
And for those who don't read, who aren't usually fantasy readers, it really straddles the fiction fantasy thing.
Cool.
Yes, so don't be put off by that one.
Catabasis by R. Kuang.
Kuang, yes.
And that's on October Scorpio Book Club.
Book Club, that's right. So check out our website for details on that event. And then we move to the fabulous English writer Sarah Moss with her new novel, Ripeness. And she's written many, many novels.
I just have to interrupt.
Yes, sorry. Go on.
I'm sorry, listeners, you don't have the pleasure that I do of having Belle pass across all these beautiful books
across the table
in the interview. And it's just such a joy to kind of be handling. And they're all brand new. They smell lovely.
They're
all so diverse and fabulous. So, sorry, I just had to interrupt because I was having ecstasy about the books.
Great.
So, so for now, we're talking about Sarah Moss, Ripeness. Tell us all about it.
So she wrote Ghost Wall and Summer Water and The Fell and many other fabulous novels. But this one is set in the 1960s and Edith is just out of school and finds herself travelling to rural Italy. She's been sent there by her mother with strict instructions to see her sister, ballet dancer Lydia, through the final weeks of her pregnancy, help at the birth, and then make the phone call, which will seal the baby's fate and her sister's fate as well. So then we jump forward, and decades later, happily divorced and newly energised, Edith is living a life of contentment and comfort, I suppose, in Ireland, but her best friend receives a call from an American man claiming to be her brother, and she's trying to decide whether or not to meet him and asks Edith for help. So it's a novel about familial love and the communities we create. It's about migration and new beginnings and what it is to have somewhere to belong. So whether you have read her before or not, this is a beautiful, luscious novel to dive into. And now because it's September and all the new glorious books are coming through the door, we started unpacking our first box of new releases and I had to scoop one up on my way in and talk about this one. It's called Buckeye by Patrick Ryan and it's getting fabulous reviews in the US. So we've been waiting for this one for a little while. So I don't know if you know, have you ever heard of what a buckeye is? So it's a little, it's a small brown nut with a fawn spot on it that's supposed to look like the eye of a deer. But it's also a slang term for people from Ohio. And it's got this folklore around it that if you carry a buckeye nut around with you, it'll bring you good luck. So already my readerly senses are tingling with the possibilities of what that might entail. So it's set in small town Ohio. It's about two families and a secret that changes everything. So it's May 1945. the news of the Allied victory in Europe has reached this small town, Ohio, and a woman called Margaret Salt walks into a hardware store and asks the man behind the counter, Cal Jenkins, for a radio. And they have this very charged moment that will change their lives and continue to ricochet through their lives and the lives of their families for generations. So it's also about while the country is reconstructing itself post-war, this little secret in this little town continues to grow and, you know, nothing can remain hidden in a small town. So the consequences of that encounter in the hardware store will untwine the fates of two families and just keep rippling through the generations and sort of asking the families to reassess themselves, reevaluate, and
wow, yeah. So an American epic.
An American epic family saga, exactly. So it's full of compassion and humour and charm, and it's a dazzling portrait of the human spirit.
And Anne Patchett,
who loves it,
who we know
and adore,
says it is a glorious sweep of a novel full of love and war and the perilous intimacies of small town life. So
exactly,
that sounds pretty marvellous. Thank
exactly.
you, Belle. That we might have to wrap it up there.
That's fine. That's perfect.
We're kind of at 20 minutes, and it's amazing how fast 20 minutes
can 20 minutes already
disappear
wow.
when we're talking about books and how marvellous they are.
But it is a magical time for books, so do come down and see us at Scorpio because there are so many wonderful new books in store.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Marianne.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Each step to the hospital window is a set of stairs, a rickety bridge, a wild road trip, a cul-de-sac of counting garden vegetables. I arrange the Scrabble letters into a recipe for dinner, a letter to my beloved, but words are curious hollows in the pillow. Every morning, I open an envelope and read a poet's poem choice inside a greeting card. I nestle into the joy of Cilla McQueen's kitchen table. The nurse changes the sheets, and it's like I sleep in the clean sheet of a poem and go hunting for first lines. Ha! I was the generation who wore anti-bomb and anti-war badges on my school bag, and now my protest badges are protest poems. Where do these thoughts come from? I listen to an Irish accent read Milkman, and I remember the wild waves thrashing at Te Hinga. A sometimes ocean calm.
That was Paula Green reading from her latest collection of poems, The Venetian Blind Poems. It's a book that was written at some of the worst times in Paula's life as she battled her third round of cancer. But Paula is hugely respected, not just for her poetry, but for her perceptive and profound reviews. Her celebration and recognition of poets and their work on her blogs, her encouragement of children's poetry, her lively and colourful children's books, and her seminal books on women's poetry and with co-editor Harry Ricketts, The Essential 99 Ways into New Zealand Poetry. She received the Prime Minister's Award for Poetry in 2017 and in the same year was made a member of the New Zealand Order of Merit. And this year she was given the Margaret Mahe Award, which is a very special award for someone who's been so so much part of children's literature over the years, Paula.
Indeed, and I just this morning I was reading these three children's books published offshore, and I was thinking I want to see versions of it here because they're really cool. Like they're about dream big, and they go into the childhood of people. Like the ones I read today were Bob Marley, Virginia Woolf, and Cristiano. Ronaldo. And I thought, music, writing, football, that's me. And when I think about who would I start with if I did a book like this in New Zealand, if we did children's books, I would start with Margaret Mahe. What an inspirational source. She was for me in the 1970s, along with Janet Frame. She was my inspiration to write, you know, and to dream big and to make those dreams happen. And I feel like not only did Margaret write books that move the child, they still do. She also had a way with other writers, and I felt, what a role model. I've seen her in the green room where she turns to the young writer next to her and she listens. And I thought, what a gift you have, you know.
She did. She did. She was a joyous presence, regardless of what might be going on in her own life. She wanted to know what people thought and felt. But let's move on to this book of your poetry, because this is born out of pain. It's born out of suffering. It's born out of terror, you know, of what might happen. But it's not a heavy, dark book at all.
No, it's not. And I think it's because there is a curious thing at work here. I feel like this is an example of writing in the present tense. And in a way, that's what I do. I live in the present tense. I live in the day, the now, which sounds Zen-like. But this is writing in the present tense. And I wasn't writing it to make a book, you know, to get published. I wrote because writing was my source of joy and aid. And I felt like when I got to go into Motutapu Ward for 5.5 weeks and have a stem cell transplant and have a young New Zealand guy gift me his stem cells, it saved my life, you know. But I found those, and I hope it comes through in the book, I found that experience on that ward, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And if I write down the words for you to describe that time, yes, there was pain, but it was also a time of absolute wonder. And what I did, I experienced humanity. I experienced nurses coming in on their day off, stretched to the limit, but every single time having the patience and the care and the kindness. And so I felt this time for me was a time of wonder. And I felt if you get gifted life, and a lot of people might have this experience, it's like, you reassess the table. You reassess what's important. And for me, it's all to do with the word care, you know. And I think when I was on that ward, it never stopped me caring about the fact of Gaza. And that's why Gaza is in the book. It's never stopped me caring right till now about the fact that our world is advancing poverty and hunger and violence and racism and all these horrible things like that. So what do you, I feel like I've just got to hold on to this core of joy and nourishment through my own writing and through my blogs, and hold on to that in this, like in my acknowledgement at the back of the book, I describe it as an upheaval world, you know. So it's kind of, and I also never, I never thought about, I just never went down the road of what if. I never went down the road of the worst scenario. Oh, this might happen to me or that. There's all kinds of bad things that might happen to me still, but I keep coming back to, I've got this day and it's a gift. I've got this day, what can I do?
The Venetian blinds, of course, were what was filtering light through to you in your room, and life was beckoning to you through those blinds, but you were looking out at life through them as well. And there's that reciprocity really that comes through a great deal in these poems of, you know, you sustaining yourself but feeling the need to nourish others as well.
Yeah, and I feel like my dedication, I was thinking, who could I dedicate this book to? There's so many people that I want to gift the book to. But, and in the end, I just dedicated it. One of the reasons I wanted to get it published was to publish it as a gift that I would give to people. And I'm thinking of the fact that so many of us are on the mountains of difficulty in all kinds of ways. And thank heavens that so many of us have a support crew, you know. And a lot of poets said to me before I went into hospital, what can I do to help? How can I help you? You know, and I went, I know. You can write an old-fashioned card and inside it put a poem you love by you or anyone else, put a stamp on it, put an address on it, and every day, because Michael came in every single day in the morning and my daughter came in every afternoon, I had limited visitors, that was it. And so I lined them up on the windowsill and the nurses would go, what are those? And I'd go, look, they're my vitamin boost for the day, and every day I'd pick one and open it. And that's why I had Cilla McQueen's The Table Poem, because someone had sent it to me. And I just thought, what a special thing. And I also had pictures all on the walls that meant a lot to me. And I also had a stack of children's books, because I feel children's books, they are of benefit no matter how old you are, because they are full of delight and humour and wit and wisdom, sadness, you know, happiness, everything. So I had this huge stack of children's books and I could just pick one up and look at a page and drift in and out of it for several hours, you know.
The thing is that while you were in there, the first part of the book, the Venetian blind portion, you weren't actually writing things down necessarily. You were doing it all in your head, which is amazing. Yeah.
Well, it's how I've often worked, you know, like my poem book, The Track, I did that in my head when I was walking a track with a broken limb. And I just feel like I begin writing in my head. I have a writing room in my head and I might be out driving. And like for the past 3 years, I do a lot of driving, getting up at 5 a.m. to go somewhere in the city for an appointment. And I just think of it as a wondrous thing, and a poem builds in my head, you know. And then I jot down things in my notebooks, and eventually one day it ends up on my laptop screen.
It's been filtered and rethought and reworked before it actually gets on the page or the screen.
Yeah. And I'm almost thinking part of it for me is, you know, I think a lot about, because I work slowly these days and I like to really spend time slowly with another poet's work. I don't want to just rush out a review every day and get through all the stack on my desk. I want to really honour that book and spend time with it. And I'm always discovering new things about what poetry is, what a poetry book is. It's so many different things. And I think for me, part of this book is that it was writing as a form of rhythm, the rhythm of the day, the music of the day. And that is important in so many other poets' writing, you know.
The second part is, you know, the first part, as we say, Venetian blinds on your window and what comes through them. But the second part is when you go home and you have an open window. And you know, things are not being filtered through this mesh or whatever you like to call it. It's open. There's air coming in. You're part of it. It's part of you. So there's a completely different sense there, but there's still that wonder, there's still that search for what's going to nourish and sustain you in this new part of your life.
Yeah, I like those words, nourish and sustain. And I ended up having really big bumps in my road and they're still not resolved. So I ended up getting something called graft versus host disease, which means that the donor cells go into battle with my cells. So I'm battleground and it manifests itself in multiple ways. And so therefore every day for me still is a patch of light and dark. So I know that after this conversation, which I'm loving, I probably won't function very well this afternoon, but that's okay. I'll lie on my bed and I'll plug in Graham Norton that I'm listening to and loving at the moment, this audio book, and I'll just wind down and then recharge to cook dinner. And I'm feeling it's a matter of looking at what you've got and how you can make it work, you know. But, yeah, I do like to hold the light, but I don't want to diminish the fact that I have dark patches all the time, really, really dark patches, and so many of us do. And how do we manage those dark patches, you know?
Yeah, how to stay optimistic. And, you know, everybody has different ways or tries different ways. Words, either your own or other people's, are so important to you. And the other thing that comes through a lot in this book is sitting around a table with either being fed or feeding other people. The table comes in a lot.
That is so important. I like cooking. I've always loved cooking. And I do cook now. And I've got a secret book that I've been working on, and it comes out of all the care things I've invented for myself. But food is an important part of it. And I feel food is, I get such joy in cooking, you know, finding the nourishing ingredients, you know, just the kinds of cuisines and sharing food with the family. And my daughters, one lives at home now and one comes over. And on Sunday night, we usually have a cook-a-thon, mother and daughters, you know. And it's just so bonding, isn't it? I mean, the other thing about the last 3 years is that I'm only just about to move back out into the world. I've been in isolation because my immune system stayed very low because of a drug I was on, and now it's sort of at the bottom of normal. And I'm planning, maybe later in the year or absolutely next year, I'm planning on doing a new thing called Poetry Shelf Goes Live. And I want to go around the country and just do the sorts of things I do on Poetry Shelf, drawing in as many different voices as I can across age and culture and style and voice and everything to kind of, you know, just, I don't know what the word is, but something all our writing poetry communities.
Well, we'll welcome you here in Otatahi, Paula, you know that.
Yeah, I can't wait to come there.
No, we can't wait to have you. How about we have another poem?
Yeah. So this is the last poem in the book. I don't know where these things come from. Most of this poem is in 1,000 pieces in a box on the table. The picture on the lid might be autobiography. It might be a red herring. There's a large grassy area. There's room for dog play. And there's the infinite blue. There's time for dream and there's time for sleep. I will meet you at the top of the hill. We will be able to see for miles.
Thank you, Paula. That was a wonderful way to end. And I hope the mountains of difficulty that you've referenced in your, and you know, that you've dedicated the book to, become little hillocks that are just, you know, bumps in the road.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah. Yeah, I love that.
It's been wonderful talking to you, and thank goodness, you know, to all the thank goodness that all the care and the science and the, as we have to really hold on to all those good things, have kept you with us. And here you are. The Venetian Blind Poems by Paula Green is published by Cuba Press.
And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.